037508, the Honorable Jeffrey Wagner versus Milwaukee County Election Commission of the State of Wisconsin. Justice Sykes will not be participating. We have appearing for Jeffrey Wagner is Michael Whitcomb. Mr. Whitcomb, you have 25 minutes. Joseph Kearney has 15. Has he checked in? There you are. Why don't you join us at the council table, okay? Good. Sorry, I didn't see you behind Mr. Whitcomb. Mr. Kearney. And Mr. Ballastrer, you have 30 minutes in rebuttal. And then, Mr. Whitcomb, you have five in response. I am sorry, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay? Mr. Whitcomb.
May it please the court. My name is Michael A.I. Whitcomb. I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner, the Honorable Jeffrey A. Wagner, in this original action brought before the court. As a prefatory matter, I'd just like to indicate to the court that Judge Wagner's absence today is certainly not indicative of any lack of interest on his part.
He hope he's working.
His very full calendar today.
Thank you.
Also, I'd like to express my thanks once again to the Office of the Attorney General, certainly Mr. Ballastrer, for taking on the advocate's role in this case, and also gratitude to express to Justice Geske and the late Honorable, the late Dean Howard Eisenberg for presenting a position in this case that I think brought information and arguments to this court which will assist in rendering its ultimate decision. This case is singularly one concerning the interpretation of the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 7, Section 10, which was enacted and ratified in the state of Wisconsin in 1848. Substantively, it has not changed since that time. It is the position of Judge Wagner that that provision, most particularly the provision which states that no justice of the Supreme Court or judge of any court of record shall hold any other office of public trust except a judicial office during the term for which elected, means one thing and only one thing. It's a prohibition of dual office holding. It was intended to, and its plain reading provides, that a judge may not at the same time hold any other office other than a judicial office, meaning that a judge may not hold a position of public trust in the executive branch or the legislative branch. I believe that ambiguity has arisen historically based upon the various interpretations of the final clause of that section during the term for which elected. I do not believe, and I strongly contend, Judge Wagner contends, that it has absolutely nothing to do, nor were the drafters concerned in any way, about preempting potential judicial corruption.
How does that square up with the history constitutionally? When they put in, you know, in the first draft, let's say in 1846, they did have this similar language, and then they put in that the judge was restricted for 2 years, and then they took it out, and they put it back into during the term. Now, and the history seems to indicate that they were concerned about a judge using his or her, most likely in this time, his position for, quote, political purposes, thinking about an independent judiciary. So I'm just asking from a historical standpoint.
Historically, in reading what is available concerning the debates of 1846 and 1848, the debates as which were directed towards the possible corruption of the judiciary. The debates were focused on whether or not the judiciary at that time should be appointed or elected. And the proponents of an elected judiciary prevailed based upon the arguments that they did not place a great deal of credence in the corruptibility, if you will, of the judiciary. I was unable to locate any debates regarding corruption as it applied to an elected judiciary. The debates focused exclusively, from the research available, on whether or not the judiciary should be appointed. And the argument was that an elected judiciary could be corrupted, or whether they should be elected and trust the electorate appoint, present the judges to the state. And those that argued the uncorruptibility or the scant likelihood of such prevailed, and thus the Constitution provided for an elected judiciary. I believe that the concerns of a judge using his or her office to secure election to a non-judicial post was addressed early on in 1847, the 1846 committee report, and the rejected Constitution of 1846, you know, stated and added the provision that you mentioned, Justice Wilcox, that if any judge shall resign his office, he shall not be eligible or appointed to any office within 2 years after such resignation.
And then that was changed to the term. So in other words, they had that in mind, that the person, at least the way I look at it, is the person couldn't serve, and then they added, in 48, they came up with the other language dealing with the term of office.
Well, that is a possible construction whereby the rejected language of 1846, which had the dual office holding prohibition in the first sentence, and then the anti-corruption provision, if you will, for the second sentence, it could be conceivably construed that that was merged into one, into the reported language, which carried on to the adopted language, which it exists today. But there's one word that, or phrase, that's in all four earlier versions, leading up to the one in 1848. And I'll use the language of the Constitution of 1848 because the clause appeared in all of them. It states that judges generally, they shall hold no office of public trust except a judicial office during the term for which they are respectively elected, and all votes for either of them. Now, the phrase either of them implies two. It's my contention that what they meant, either of them, is either the judicial office or the non-judicial office. Only the votes for the judicial office would be counted. And that language flowed through all of the four versions of section, or Article 7, Section 10, and which would clearly implies, if not explicitly, states that the provision was only concerned with a dual office-holding prohibition. Also,
Mr. Whitcomb, if I could interrupt you for a minute.
You may.
When I look at this case, and I want you to help me maybe get over my perceptions at this point, but when I look at this case, it looks to me like all three branches of Wisconsin government have been consistent in their interpretation. When I say that, we've got the McCarthy case from this court, which is contrary to your position. We've got the Attorney General's opinions through the years, which appear to be contrary to your position, and also leading up to the action by the Wisconsin legislature in the mid-90s, where the legislature approved a proposed amendment when I say approved it, they presented it to the electorate to amend this provision, the Legislative Reference Bureau making it clear that the reason for the amendment was to eliminate this prohibition against judges running during the term or being appointed during the term. So you've got the legislative branch in the mid-90s most recently saying there's a problem with your interpretation. You've got the judicial branch in the McCarthy case saying that the interpretation is contrary to your position. You've got the executive branch through the Attorney General's office rendering AG's opinions which appear contrary to your position. And you've got the electorate in the mid-90s saying, no, we don't want to change this constitutional provision. Now, how do you get around all that?
We come before this court, which is the final arbiter of the meaning of the Wisconsin Constitution. The referendum was presented, I believe, to clear up an ambiguity. Certainly, decisions of this court cannot be overturned by a referendum any more than the Constitution of this state can be interpreted by a referendum. As regards the referendum, just from a practical matter, it was finally approved by the fourth vote of the state senate in February. It went to vote 5 weeks later in April. Respectfully submit, practically, the voters really did not know nor understand nor have explained to them, other than the language of the referendum itself, what the issue was. As regards the legislative interpretation, the director of state courts took a contrary position. Even though the staff memorandum to Mr. Jensen, Senator Jensen, he recited the various opinions of the Attorney General's office. The memorandum couched its language and may be interpreted as such. As regards the McCarthy decision, the McCarthy decision was a political decision. It was a case politically motivated. It was a case that was used to keep McCarthy off the ballot. And the only thing they could hang their hat on was this provision of the Constitution, and which the first McCarthy case did address squarely, certainly not by the standards that this court uses today in interpreting provisions of the Wisconsin Constitution. It referred to the argument as being ingenious that this provision of the Wisconsin Constitution could keep McCarthy off the ballot. And then they just went to the issue saying that the Wisconsin court, or the state of Wisconsin, could not preempt federal regulations as to the availability of a candidate for a federal office. I don't believe that McCarthy certainly didn't address squarely the issue as to whether or not that language of the Constitution meant what the petitioners in that case contended it did. I think that is evident in McCarthy too, because when McCarthy was brought up on discipline charges, if you will, in an original action before this court, they did not allege in their petition that he had violated his oath as a judge or his oath as an attorney by violating that provision of the Constitution. So McCarthy clearly two sentences within the decision that maybe has been relied on to say that this provision of the Constitution prevents a judge from holding any other non-judicial office during the term for which elected, but I don't think it definitively addressed the issue which we're asking the court to do today.
You think if we adopted your position that we'd have to overrule the McCarthy decision or at least claim that the language from McCarthy was being withdrawn by this court?
I think the language of McCarthy was dicta, at least in the first decision, I think it was dicta.
Well, you know that this court on numerous occasions has said that what we say when we take up an issue and decide it, that it's not dicta.
Correct.
How is that dicta?
With court referred to the argument as being ingenious, that Article 7, Section 10 prohibited McCarthy from being holding a non-judicial office during its term. It didn't adopt that argument. It's akin to a case I came across in another case I was working on involving the safe place statute. And there's numerous decisions that define what safe place is applicable to residential units of two or more, and various interpretations in Court of Appeals decisions imply that two units means one thing, means another thing. This court said, well, the issue is not squarely before us, and we're not going to address it. But I think it's that type of scenario. It wasn't definitively defined by the court in McCarthy, one. It said that the argument indicated that it was ingenious, but the case was not decided based upon that argument. The case was decided based upon the fact that state law could not regulate the eligibility for office at the federal level. The term, final phrase of the Constitution, during the term for which elected, has two purposes, I believe. One, without that term, the Constitution would read on its face that a judge, once a judge, was always a judge, and could never at any time hold a non-judicial office, even after resignation, even after the term expired.
Oh, no. No, wait a minute. After, in other words, the term that judge, because I'm just looking, during the term for which they are respectively elected, are elected. So, they could, after their term ended, you said ever.
But if that clause wasn't entered, was not in the Constitution, I'm arguing the purpose that clause was inserted was not to keep a resigned judge from not holding a non-judicial office after resignation. That term was inserted to make certain that after the judge was no longer a judge for any purposes, he or she could hold a non-judicial office of public trust. Because without that ending clause, it would read, no justice of the Supreme Court or judge of any court of record shall hold any other office of public trust except a judicial office, period. That on its face would be an absolute bar for any judge at any time holding a non-judicial office of public trust, even after the term expired. The second reason I believe that
I just a minute. Even yes. After the term expired?
Correct.
Why? Let me just ask you. In today's world, that if a justice of this court wanted to resign tomorrow and run for governor, today is Wednesday, run for governor on Thursday, they could do that. Under the interpretation, in other words, unless you want us to put some limitations on it, but I mean,
once the office is vacated, under any circumstances, the term ends, period, under the operative meaning of this provision of the Constitution.
What do you think? Are you finished, Justice?
Yes, I'm finished, thank you.
What do you think were the purposes which this article is addressed? What is it that they're seeking? What is it that they were seeking to achieve?
They did not want a member of the judicial branch also serving in the executive branch or in the legislative branch.
Simultaneously?
Correct. It's a dual office holding prohibition.
Well, that is easily accomplished by simply saying it can't hold two offices. I mean, this language goes far beyond that. Now, your amicus here says that I think I agree with him, that one of the policies is to remove the incentive for a judge to use his or her judicial position to further their ambitions for other public office. Would you agree with that?
No. Because if that was the case, then why would it be for only non-judicial offices? Certainly the same corruptibility of individuals be applicable to a judge seeking re-election, would be applicable to a circuit judge seeking a seat on the Court of Appeals, would be applicable to a Court of Appeals judge seeking position in the Supreme Court. I mean, to be elected to a non-judicial office, the corruptibility of that proposition is no different than the potential corruption of a judge seeking re-election for his or her own position or for seeking
the appointment. 7-10-1 says you can't, it can hold, can't hold any other office except a judicial office, so it makes the exception that you're raising now.
So in other words, a judge from the circuit court or a judge from the Court of Appeals can run simultaneous, hold that office, and run for the Supreme Court, and they've done so. I mean, they can do that. In other words, they can hold
the office of a Court of Appeals during their six-year term if it's a circuit court judge. Well,
and they also could be running for the Supreme Court while holding the office of the
Court. Correct. If the intent of this provision is prevent corruption of judicial decisions for those judges seeking non-judicial offices, the same arguments were applicable to judges seeking re-election or seeking a higher judicial office.
Mr. Wetzel, I'd like to ask you again, or ask you to discuss again, this language of the original Constitution. In all votes for either of them, for any office except a judicial office, given by the legislature or the people, shall be void. Why was that in there? It seems to me, with all due respect, that the they refers to judges of the Supreme Court or judges of the Circuit Court. But what was the purpose of having that in there?
I believe the issue they were getting at, and this language has appeared in other constitutions and in other states, certainly in the one case, the Clements case, the Texas Constitution. I believe what it says is that if you're a sitting judge and you are elected to a non-judicial office, that the votes for either of them will not be counted or shall be void except for the votes for a judicial office, meaning it prevents the dual office holding prohibition. That if the votes are going to be the votes for either of them, non-judicial, judicial office, only the votes for the judicial office shall be counted, the other votes shall be void. I also believe that during the term for which elected, also provided the executive the ability to appoint a person to a vacated judgeship, and that appointed from the executive or legislative branch, and that appointed person could hold two positions, take a leave of absence, whatever the contemplation was, could hold a position. Let's say the governor appointed the lieutenant governor to fill a vacated circuit judgeship. That lieutenant governor could hold that appointment as a circuit judge, could retain his position as lieutenant governor up until the time he is elected, and he or she is elected. If he or she was not elected, they could return to their post in the executive branch of government, and if they were elected, they couldn't hold the dual office position. I believe that was the two purposes, arguable purposes, for that clause in the Constitution. I don't believe that there was any concern whatsoever about judges being more susceptible to corruption because of what they do than any other elected officials, legislative or executive, and I do not believe that they would have made a distinction or thought there would be a distinction that a judge seeking a non-judicial office would be more corruptible, if you will, than a judge seeking re-election or a judge seeking an higher office.
What is the significance of Circuit Judge Doolittle being elected to the United States Senate in the mid-1850s?
prior McCarthy. I would say that the interpretation of that provision was not what the state is arguing today. There was merely a dual office holding prohibition, and as I understand it, once he assumed a seat, he no longer was a circuit judge.
Does it say anything about contemporaneous interpretation of the provision, one way or the other?
Does what say anything about the contemporaneous interpretation of the provision?
Judge Doolittle election to the United States Senate.
I think it definitely would.
Okay, I mean, I fed you the question. You gave me an easy answer, but give me an explanation. I see. Well, with due respect, why? It comes to my mind. It comes to my mind as a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question. But, of course, you have a contemporaneous, or may have a contemporaneous interpretation. 1848 statehood, you know, with the Constitution. But I'm not sure that's true. It just flips in and out of my mind. So is there any merit to that? And if so, what is it and why?
I would believe that the same firms that were involved in drafting the Constitution of 1848 were involved in the advancement of political affairs in 1850, and Mr. Doolittle was probably known by them as the drafters of the Constitution were known locally, and had there been a prohibition or contemporaneous intent of that provision to bar the circuit judge or Mr. Doolittle from being in the Senate, it certainly would have been brought to his attention by the opponents of the day. I don't know if it's a policy, I don't even know if it's a policy question, but the interpretation that the state puts on this provision is totally unnecessary today as it was in 1848. Under today's judicial ethics, judges are required to resign before they seek or become a candidate for a federal, state, or local office. Why would that judicial rule, Supreme Court rule, be in existence if this Constitution was a bar for them doing so under any circumstances, but for a federal office?
Let me ask, so this will come back to the question I have, is that you could, under your interpretation of Green Lights On, you could resign from the bench at any time and the next day run for a political office. So if you don't have to announce your candidacy, but you certainly could have a platform for discussing whatever issues you may want within the judicial system. So I'm just saying today, unless we put in some bars, some slice and dice, go 1 year, 2 year, if you read this as it is, that a judge, according to the Constitution, could not serve in any other capacity during his or her term. You're saying that is wrong, that you can resign and the next day announce your candidacy.
Yes, sir, and a judge would be at extreme risk politically and ethically from engaging in any activity which would be construed as being a candidate before that time.
Right, thank
you. Thank you, Mr. Whitcomb. Mr. Kearney?
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the Court. Petitioner presents an interesting constitutional question, but it is, as presented to this Court, an academic question. That is because several justiciability doctrines make this petition an inappropriate vehicle and make dismissal the appropriate course of action. First, this case is moot. By petitioner's own description, this case was premised on his interest in standing in last spring's election for Milwaukee County Executive. But that election has occurred, and so this Court's ruling necessarily will have no impact on the stated reason that this petition was filed. Even beyond this, petitioner has not identified even a likely practical consequence to him in the future. In the submissions such as the party stipulations, and even in his own briefs, indeed, even in his reply brief after Amicus raised the point, petitioner makes no statement that he is even contemplating running for some specific office while he holds his judgeship. Second, it is important to appreciate that, apart from mootness, there are other justiciability reasons as to why the court should decline to rule in this matter. In particular, the requisite adversity of interest does not exist between the parties here. What has the state of Wisconsin done, proposed to do, or failed to do that has any practical bearing on this matter? The answer is nothing. All that it has done is to agree to file a brief, taking a different position from petitioner. Adversity of interest is a requirement under the Declaratory Judgment Act and under this court's precedents. But even doubts about its presence can form an appropriate basis for this court's declining to exercise its discretionary jurisdiction and thus not to rule on the matter.
Counsel, do you believe that there is some doubt out there right now as to how this article should be interpreted?
Yes. There is doubt about any number of provisions in the law, and one ordinarily waits for a case that presents some ripe controversy with parties on opposite sides that both have an interest in litigating the matter before a court issues a ruling.
You view this as an advisory opinion?
I view this, Amicus views this, as a case where the court may have the power under this court's constitution, under this court's precedent, to hear the case, but one where it is inadvisable to do so.
Well, as we've seen from what happened with Amicus here, these questions can arise overnight. And, I mean, as I recall the sequence of events that led to Justice Geske's appointment, it was like 24 hours or something, and certainly no time for her to gain any kind of a statement from this court as to whether or not what she was doing was appropriate under the law. There's nothing to prevent that in the future. So shouldn't we clarify the law now?
Not in this case with this particular respondent. One should wait for a case where there's some particular reason to believe that the current petitioner has some reasonably specific interest in getting this matter resolved now, and in which there is an appropriate respondent.
Who would be an appropriate respondent? I mean, you want another candidate who wants to knock somebody off the ballot, or give me an example of an appropriate respondent.
An appropriate respondent might be someone who refused to place a candidate's name on a ballot. It would seem to me that a petition for a writ of mandamus, fileable, I might add, in the circuit courts of this state, one does not have to resort to the original jurisdiction of this court to get its matter resolved, would make an appropriate vehicle for resolving the controversy.
The Elections Commission in Milwaukee at first said they wouldn't place the judge's name on the ballot. I mean, it was...
The Election Commission of Milwaukee indicated to this court that it was not willing to serve as the respondent, and this court permitted the Election Commission to bow out. With respect, that does not make the Election Commission of Milwaukee County an inappropriate respondent in another action where there is some specific reason to think that the petitioner has some current interest in getting the matter resolved.
Well, Mr. Kearney, I look at this case is that there's a real institutional interest here to resolve this question. I think I agree with your statements of public policy, the purposes for which this article was tendered and is part of our Constitution, and that is, as you state in here somewhere, the incentive for judges to use the concern is the incentive for judges to use their judicial positions to position themselves for elective politics. You say that on page 14.
Yes.
I tend to agree with that. And that the people have a right not only to have, but appear to have, a totally independent judiciary. And that, I think, gets called into question with the position taken by at least arguably, taken by Mr. Wagner and by yourself in this amicus brief.
Well, let me then move to the merits. Let me note, finally, with respect to the justiciability issues, that we do have in this case an amalgamation of four things that I believe make this case an inappropriate vehicle for resolving the matter. First, we have a constitutional provision that even under the extreme position that is given to it by the state and by a number of others, has served the people of the state well for 154 years by providing some sort of structural safeguard against even the appearance of a sitting judge's using his position to maneuver for political office. Second, a petitioner whose self-stated interest no longer exists. Third, a respondent who does not have some identifiable interest in the case. And fourth, and finally, it seems to me that while the case affects the judiciary and potentially its own members, it is especially important that this court adhere to established neutral principles of justiciability and not simply shunt aside the mootness, lack of adversity, and other flaws in petitioner's case. With respect to the merits, amicus believes that both petitioner and respondent have some points, if you will, on their side. Among other things, petitioner notes that the provision by its terms speaks of another of a judge's holding another office of public trust and does not speak of a judge is running for another office. Respondent, for its part, makes the point that Article 7, Section 10 has long been thought by many to apply even after a judge has left office. But ultimately, amicus does not agree with either of these extreme interpretations, for under Ms. Geske's view, a term, as that word is used in Article 7, Section 10 of the Constitution, expires when a judge has resigned from office and a successor has been duly elected by the people of this state.
Professor Kearney, if I might, let me interrupt for a minute. Do you think that this prohibition in the Wisconsin Constitution applies to reserve judges?
I don't know. I would have to do research with respect to what is meant by any judge of any court of record, and I would have to look at the statutes of the legislature with regard to what it says with respect to a reserve judge.
Well, let's assume for a minute that it applies to a reserve judge. If it does, then the solution that you suggest doesn't fit, does it? Because a reserve judge isn't elected. A reserve judge is appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court generally on a year-by-year basis.
That's covered by the statute.
It's possible it's not covered by the Constitution because the Constitution talks about elected judges.
Right, and the reserve judge is not elected.
Yes, that would be my best and short answer to the question at this time.
So your position would be that it doesn't apply to reserve judges?
It appears that it may not apply to reserve judges, and it appears that it may not apply to judges who are appointed by the governor to fill out the duration of someone else's term and who themselves never stand for election.
Wouldn't that seem to run counter to the purposes of the provision as you've outlined them in your brief?
It would mean that the legislature has only taken an incomplete approach to addressing the universe of potential evils that one could design a provision such as this to address. In other words, it would mean that the legislature has struck some sort of balance between the competing concerns, the concern on the one hand with not having sitting judges electioneering from the bench, and the concern on the other hand with not disqualifying qualified individuals from any elective office for an unreasonably long period of time, such as long as 8 or 9 years in the case of members of this court. It would mean that the legislature has taken, as the legislature frequently does, some sort of piecemeal approach where it thinks that the concerns are particularly prevalent in some areas, but it has decided that the balance with respect to others, such as reserve judges or appointed judges, points the other way.
It seems like, could I ask you, if we were to buy the state's argument, what would be the practical effect on Justice Geske's service as county executive?
Amicus says no position at this time with respect to any practical effect that announcement of the state's interpretation as the law of this state would signify for her or for any actions that she took in that office.
Counsel, let me tell you the problem I have with your position and see if you can answer it. I think it's better than what has been propounded by Mr. Wagner. If you take as a fundamental premise, and I do, that the purpose of this section is to remove the incentive for judges to use their positions, judicial positions, to further their ambitions for other public office. Or to,
I do.
Yeah, and I do too. Now, you and I both know, and all of us know, that today's campaigns are very, very money dependent. Now, even under your suggestion, it would be very possible, it would be accomplishable for, let's say, a fifth year member of this court to resign in November, to immediately the next day begin to raise money for a run for governorship that was up the following year. And, of course, during the course of raising that money, go back to the people, and obviously this doesn't affect your client, doesn't affect Amicus, go back to the people who had big cases in front of us, or in the case of a trial judge, who had big cases in front of that trial judge. You see the point that I'm making there. It's almost indistinguishable. In a year, to raise money is nothing. So that judge is going to be going out there with these decisions and these clients in his or her background, fresh from having discarded his judicial robes in an effort to raise money. And just the appearance of that strikes me as being something that we as a judiciary want to avoid.
The judge whom you describe could do that only if no other justice of this court were scheduled to stand for an election in the following spring, and as often as not, there is going to be such an election.
Let me take a circuit judge in this third year.
In that case, it seems to me that what we have is a legislative policy that has attempted to balance various concerns. There is no question that the concern that Your Honor describes is a real concern, and that it would be a rational public policy for the people of this state, whether through the legislature, whether through the Constitution, or whether through this court, to design a prohibition against the type of situation that you describe.
Okay, so what difference does it make whether or not you resign in midterm or a year before it ends, or your term is up? My term is up in 2009. I plan to run again. Suppose I decide I'm going to run for governor. It won't surprise you. People have even suggested that. So I'm going to run for governor. It's up August 1, July 31. I don't know if 2010 is a governor year or not. So I'm going to run for governor. I start out on August 1 campaigning for governor and raising money. All of the ills that Justice Babbage has set forth apply to me. I've sat and I can call my cases on the basis of the contributions I'm going to make. There's nothing in any of these statutes or our Constitution to stop that.
The difference that it makes is that there is only one point in an entire 10-year period where the circumstance that you describe could exist. And the legislature and the people of the state are entitled to design a policy that speaks to 99% of the situations, to eliminate 99% of the possibilities of evil, even if it does not eliminate all possible evils. That's the difference that it makes. Also,
the evil is there. The evil is there.
The evil is there. May I?
In 99% of the cases, it's there. The scenario that I described.
May I?
Yes, of course.
Have one more sentence. The evil is there, but what we have to deal with is the text of Article 7, Section 10 of the Wisconsin Constitution, and when it's read in conjunction with Section 17.19 of the statutes, and in conjunction with the rational attempt to balance the concerns that Justice Babbage describes on the one hand, and the concerns that petitioner describes on the other hand, of highly competent people not being disabled from office for an unreasonable period of time, what you will end up with is an imperfect but useful provision such as Article 7, Section 10 of the Constitution.
That leads me to Article 4, Section 12, which has been called to my attention by Justice Brasser. That no member of the legislature shall, during the term for which he was elected, be appointed or elected to any civil office in the state which shall have been created, or the emoluments of which shall have been increased during the term for which he was elected. I mean, it's a limitation on legislators getting other office.
Yes.
Okay. And I've read some of the opinions of the AG, and I've read some of our cases. And they take the position that that constitutional provision should be narrowly and strictly construed in favor of eligibility because of the concept which you've set forth. Namely, you ought to encourage people to run for public office or seek public office and get it, and not bar legislators.
It is one thing to construe narrowly in favor of eligibility a provision that would restrict the public representatives of the people, such as legislatures, from seeking other offices. And it is quite another to narrowly construe a provision that disables judges or justices from pursuing political office.
Well, aren't you asking us to narrowly construe it when you ask us to interpret term to mean with the balance of the term until some other judge is elected so that that second judge has his or her own term?
We are asking you to give the word term in the Constitution an interpretation and an effect, as amicus believes that petitioner's position does not adequately do, and we are asking you to give it a common sense interpretation. Time, there are 7 members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, each serving a term, and we are asking you to construe it harmoniously with the legislature's statutes on the matter, and in a way that gives respect to the conceitedly competing policies here between permitting the public to have confidence in its judiciary on the one hand, and permitting qualified people not to be disabled from elective office for an unreasonable period of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Balistrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you. For a lot of...
Is this a moot court for you?
Is this a moot court?
Yeah. What's your interest? What's the state's interest here?
Well, the state's interest is primarily that the court has asked us to file a brief, which we did.
Well, that's why I raised it.
But
you're here because you represent the court?
I think we represent the state of Wisconsin. That's the party whose name appears on my brief, State of Wisconsin,
okay.
Respondent. If you're asking, is there some adversity here?
Yeah.
Actually, I think there is. I think there is some real adversity.
You're adverse?
Between the petitioner and the state of Wisconsin, I think. The state of Wisconsin, the people of the state of Wisconsin, on at least two different occasions, once in 1848 and again in 1995, have clearly stated that their will is that the judges of this state should not be eligible to hold another office during the term for which they are elected. Judge Wagner is here to try to overturn the will of the people, as expressed in 1848 and as expressed again in 1995. And I think the interest of the Attorney General here today is to defend the will of the people against the attack that Judge Wagner has made. So I think there is a real adversity. I don't think I'm just here playing devil's advocate. I don't think I'm just here to hear my voice echo in this hallowed chamber in a moot court. I think there's a real adversity here.
You used the word eligibility, but I don't see the word eligibility in that first sentence of Article 7, Section 10. I do see it in the second sentence.
Right, yeah, you're right. It doesn't, the word eligibility does not appear in the particular provision that we're dealing with, but it is essentially an eligibility provision, because what it holds is that, or what it states is that that a judge cannot hold another office, in essence meaning he's not eligible to hold another office during the term for which he is elected.
Could I ask you, is Jeanine Geske a justice of the Supreme Court?
No, she is not. She's the dean of a law school.
Yes, well,
at the moment.
Then why couldn't she hold any office she wanted to?
Because the term for which she was elected to the Supreme Court, the 10-year term, has not yet expired. That term is still pending.
But it says, no justice of the Supreme Court shall hold any office.
During the term for which she is elected.
She's not a justice of the Supreme Court.
No, but she was. She was when she was elected.
Well, now, in the original provision in the Constitution, it talks about judges of the Supreme Court shall receive a salary payable quarterly of not less than $1,500 annually. Would someone get that salary after they left the court?
Of course not. But see, this is, I think, your question goes to the nub of Mr. Whitcomb's argument that somehow the term for which a judge or justice is elected is coterminous with the term that a judge or justice actually serves. And that's not true. These are two separate and distinct things. The term for which, it's like the difference between a question of fact and a question of law. As a matter of law, provided in the Constitution, the term for which, well, let's just use the justice of this court since we're talking about Justice Geske. The term for which a justice is elected is 10 years. That term continues for 10 years as a matter of law. As a matter of fact, a justice, like Justice Geske, may not serve her full term. She may serve only, I think, 4 years out of the 10-year term. So the term that she actually served is 4 years. But the term for which she was elected is 10 years. The voters of this state authorized Jeanine Geske to sit on this bench for 10 years. That has never changed. Nothing has changed by her resignation. That authorization continues.
If the Constitution were that clear, why didn't the state of Wisconsin swoop down on her when it was announced she was going to be sworn in as county executive of Milwaukee?
One would have to ask someone from the state of Wisconsin who was in a position to swoop down on her. I suspect that there were a whole lot of reasons why. We all know what.
Is it your position today that her service was unlawful?
Yes. Does that mean that everything that she did was unlawful? No. Because you have to make a distinction. And this is very interesting, because this goes back to the very first case I ever argued in this court.
That was a long time.
Did you win?
Yes, I did.
Yes, I did. You'd remember that.
Sorry. Wasn't quite that long ago, but almost.
Like that.
But almost that long ago.
Okay, tell us
about
the
very first case I ever argued involved the question of de jure versus de facto office holding. There was a case by the name of Paminette. Still remember that name.
He hasn't been in prison long. That's Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah. But at any rate, the holding of this court was that you have to make a distinction between de jure office holding and de facto office holding, and that even if someone holds an office illegally, as long as they are holding the office de facto, the acts that they do are legal.
Counsel, does your interpretation then leave us with the situation where two people can be serving a term for the same office at the same time?
Oh, no. No, of course not. No, you can only have one incumbent. You can only have one person who is actually serving.
Okay, they're actually serving,
right.
And yet the existence of the term, in your example, for Justice Geske, she would still be serving a term at the same time that Justice Prosser would be serving the term for the same chair.
No, she's not serving the term. Only Justice Prosser.
Her term would still be alive.
The term for which she was elected, that is the legal term, not the factual term. The legal term is still there. And you can have parallel legal terms. They run on parallel tracks. There's no conflict.
Concurrent, even, you're saying, not
concurrent.
Just parallel. Let me take you back, if I may, to the 1850s.
A great era.
I know, those thrilling days of yesteryear. Justice Prosser asked a question about a circuit court judge running, and I raised the possibility of the import of that example being contemporaneous interpretation, that is, 1850, 1848. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not an interpretation at all. I mean, first of all, there could be all kinds of reasons why this particular judge ran for the Senate and was allowed to do so. Politics being right at the top of that list, let's just assume for a moment that what he did, what this judge did, was illegal. And I underline the word assume for the moment. It could well be that a lot of people who were in a position of political power thought this guy, this judge, would make a great senator, so nobody complained, even though everybody thought that what he did was illegal. So the fact that he did it doesn't mean anything. And if I may just finish up, which was one sentence, as this court held in McCarthy, what he did was not illegal because of the fact that the state constitution cannot override federal regulations dealing with eligibility for federal office. So what he did was not illegal. What he did was perfectly legal.
I'm not sure this is correct. So let me ask it in a hypothetical. I have the biographies of some of the early justices who were around in the 1850s and ran in the 1860s.
You have the biography of Chief Justice Ryan, who is kind of my hero in this litigation?
Well, one of the fellows...
You know, this bust is out there. I wanted to bring it in, but it was too heavy.
One of the fellows that was serving right with him at the same time. Now, this is a William Lyons, who was also Chief Justice and serving at the same time as Ryan. They appear right next to each other in this book of biographies. And Lyons apparently was appointed for a judgeship in 1865, and he left the army. He was in the army and took that judgeship in 1865, and then ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Congress in 1870. If those are six-year terms, it looks like he's running during his six-year term, but for the Congress, apparently. He would say
In the McCarthy opinion, the court mentions three people who ran for federal office while they were sitting on the bench.
And then at about the same time, or maybe, I guess about the same time, these guys were all serving together, we have David Taylor, who he was in 1857 appointed to the Fourth Judicial Circuit, I'm not sure about this, and held the position for the next 12 years. So if the terms are six, that would be two terms. But then, on the 12th year, he returned to the State Senate for another term. He had come from the State Senate. I guess that example just piques my curiosity whether or not that was a contemporaneous interpretation.
Well, if I understand your factual example, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, he, while a judge, he ran for the Senate, the State Senate.
Let me put this hypothetically, because I don't, you know the, I have the years, but I don't have the months here, so hypothetically, okay. Let's say he did it. If he hypothetically ran for the State Senate while still serving a term for on the circuit court, would that have any import in terms of interpretation of the 1848 Constitution?
Okay, I think the answer to your question is that this constitutional prohibition does not prohibit a judge from running for another office. It prohibits a judge from holding another office. So that you can have a situation, let's say someone's judicial term expires next year. Well, let's say someone's judicial term expired this last July 31st, since we do have a legislative election going on. Let's say someone's term expired July 31st. This constitutional provision would not have precluded that judge from running in April, May, June, and July for a legislative office that will not be held until next January 1st.
So, let's put it here in my seat. I could run for, my term ends in 2005, and let's say I wanted to run for governor. I could start my election right now and run for governor in 2006. As a sitting justice, that's your interpretation.
Well, no, you couldn't. No, you couldn't. But not because of this constitutional prohibition. You couldn't do it because of your own Supreme Court rule that prevents you from...
Okay, but we're not talking about Supreme Court rule or actually most of the statutory provisions. We're talking about constitutional interpretation.
Right, right.
And it's your interpretation of this constitutional provision that I could sit here and for the next 4 years run for governor, finish out my term on the 2005 July 31, and be ready and raring to go in November. That's what your interpretation results in. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and that's why I assume that this court felt the need to create a rule that prevents a judge from running for office while sitting on the bench.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. How does that interpretation address Justice Babbage's concerns of corruption and selling your vote or capitalizing on your vote if I can be running for governor and sitting here and deciding these cases according to your interpretation of this constitutional provision?
Well, like I said, you can't be running for
governor. Yeah, but I'm talking about interpretation of this constitutional provision.
You can't rely on that code. That code didn't come into effect until 1967 or even later than that. Before that, there wasn't a code.
That's right.
So we're dealing with pre-code.
Okay.
No, we're not.
Well, but the point of the matter is, she's asking you, the justice is asking you, in terms of interpretation of a constitution and a statute when you have no code, which was from 1848 to roughly 1968, if my date is right on the code. So what's your answer?
May have been statutory provisions.
Yeah, there were some statutes that were enacted in there too. But as far as the Constitution, I'll answer your pure constitutional question, and I will answer it by going back even farther to the debates on the Constitution. This is absolutely fascinating reading. This is the third case I've had that involved a question of state statutory construction. And every time I've had to deal with one of these questions, just reading Quaife's books, it's just absolutely fascinating to see the give and the take and the debate and the various positions that people have. But what this provision represents, a compromise. It represents not only an ideological compromise, but it represents a practical compromise. Is it a perfect solution to the problem of judges pandering for votes? No, it's not. And I frankly don't think that there is a perfect solution, except maybe the solution that Justice Ryan proposed, which was to have appointment of judges. Then you wouldn't have elections, you wouldn't have people pandering. You know, at least this is what the feds think. That's their position, which is why federal judges have lifetime appointments. But the people in the Constitutional Convention in 1848, who were kind of caught up in the movement at the time, which was to elect judges, obviously prevailed, but they were nevertheless deferential to the concerns that were expressed by then Mr. Ryan about the problems that are inherent in judges running for election. Whether it's running for election to some kind of a political office, or whether it's running for re-election to the same judicial office or to a higher judicial office. And it's true, you know, that there are problems regardless of which office a judge is running for. There's always this possibility of pandering. But then there are some practical problems. Anytime you have judges that are elected for a finite term, they're going to have to run for re-election. And you're going to have the problem of at least the possibility of a judge pandering. And I underscore possibility here, because fortunately we don't see that too often. We see it once in a while, but not very often. But that possibility is there anytime a judge has to run for re-election. If a circuit judge runs for an appellate judgeship, the problem is there too. But we have a practical problem. And this is why Mr. Kilbourne, moved in the 1848 convention to make this provision inapplicable to people who ran, inapplicable to circuit judges who ran for the Supreme Court. I'm not sure if the court realizes this, but in 1848, do you have any idea how many trial judges we had in this state? We had five.
They were also the Supreme Court, Mr. Balestrieri.
I'm sorry?
They were also the Supreme Court.
And
they sat on their own cases and reversed themselves.
They sat on their own cases, that's right.
Complained when the other justices reversed them. Anyway.
But we had five, circuit or trial judges. They were called district judges back then. We had five of them for the whole state. And there was
those were the good old days, Mr. Balestrieri.
There was a real practical problem with only five trial judges. If you made this provision applicable to those five trial judges, you would almost never have a situation. It would be extremely rare in which any one of those five trial judges could ever run for the Supreme Court. When we did get the Supreme Court. So that's why Mr. Kilbourn proposed and succeeded in having this amendment passed to eliminate judges, so that we could have circuit judges running for the Supreme Court. It was just a matter of pure practicality, and so what we wound up with basically was a provision that didn't address all of the evils. It didn't address the evil of a judge, the potential evil, of a judge running for re-election to the same judgeship or a judge running for a higher judgeship for practical reasons. But it addressed...
I would suggest it was special interest, not practical reasons.
Well, Mr. Kilbourn wasn't a judge.
Were mostly lawyers who are going to be judges. Go ahead.
Justice Babbage has added enough of that answer. Let me follow up then. You suggest there's a give and take, and there was, you know, I love this stuff to read this stuff too, but your interpretation of the Constitution to me, in terms of how it plays out, isn't a matter of some kind of compromise. It's the worst possible interpretation, nothing personal. It's the worst possible interpretation when you are trying to address the possibility of corruption. Your definition of this constitutional provision allows me to run for governor in 2006 starting today. And if that interpretation is some middle ground, I'd like to see what the other edge interpretation is.
Well,
if that's some compromise, I think that's a horrendous result. If you're talking about the goal of trying to minimize the potential corruptions.
All right. Well, see, this was my point. This was my point, that this constitutional provision in and of itself is not a perfect solution to the problem. What it does address is perhaps the most egregious situation, and that is a judge who is supposed to be neutral, and most judges are, but all of them are supposed to be, running for an office in which that office holder is not supposed to be neutral, in which that office holder, whether it's a senator, whether it's a representative, whether it's the governor, is not supposed to be neutral. That person, by definition, is supposed to represent the interests of their constituents, whatever those interests happen to be, whether they happen to be Republicans, or Democrats, or liberals, or conservatives, or whatever. A senator or a representative or even the governor is supposed to represent the people who elected that person. That's not what a judge is supposed to do. So what this provision does is address the most egregious problem. making room for the practical necessities of having judges run for election to judgeships. Now, if, as you say, and as I say, there is a problem because this constitutional provision does not address the question of a judge running for another office, I think what was probably going through the minds of the people who adopted this provision was something different. You know, I think in 1848 you didn't have the situation that you have today, and you're absolutely right. You have a situation in which people start running for office years ahead of time, 2 years, 4 years ahead of time. I don't think that existed back in 1848, and they just didn't think about it. They just didn't think about the problem of having somebody run for an office that they would not be eligible to hold for another 6 years. I think what they were envisioning was a situation in which if you couldn't hold the office for 6 years or 3 years or 2 years, you just weren't going to bother running for that office.
Mr. Balistrieri, it seems to me your strongest argument is that the Constitution has been authoritatively interpreted in the McCarthy litigation. Mr. Whitcomb says that was highly political. I think more significant to us is the fact that there isn't really a textual or historical analysis of the Constitution in the McCarthy litigation the way that we would now. I mean, actual words and all the debate that has now come before us and the contemporaneous interpretation of it. Why should we put that much stock in the McCarthy litigation?
Well, first of all, to say that the McCarthy decision was political, I'm not sure what Mr. Whitcomb meant by that, but I would say that the reason for bringing the litigation was certainly political. There were a lot of people who did not like Joe McCarthy even before he became a senator. But the court's decision itself was not political, not at all. There's no hint in the court's decision of any kind of political bias. In fact, what this court said in the first McCarthy case was, Joe, you can run for senator. That's okay. In the second case, when there was a disciplinary proceeding brought against him, what the court said was, yeah, you violated the Constitution. You ran for senator. You took the office of senator when you shouldn't have. But it was de minimis, so we're not going to do anything about it. Nothing at all. Nothing at all political about the court's decision in that case. I think what the court had in mind was to actually educate members of the bar, and particularly members of the bench, as to just what the Constitution meant, what it was supposed to deal with. While it's true there was not an extended discussion, as we have in the briefs here, it was nevertheless a matter that the court deliberately took up. It was a matter that the court deliberately decided. It's not dictum. It's a binding decision.
Well, counsel, I bet
we
have just as many cases that say that there's dictum as the ones that say if the court said it, it's not dictum. We've got cases that say there's dicta in Wisconsin. And I'm sorry, I've interrupted. Go ahead, Justice.
Could I ask you, I think it was significant that the original Constitution had this language about the vote shall not be counted. That was taken out in 1977. Is that significant?
I don't see it as particularly significant. I think it was just redundant. I mean, if the fact if the fact of the matter is that a particular person could not hold the office, then it didn't matter whether you counted the votes or not. He couldn't hold the office, one way or the other. It strikes me, and I have to admit that I have not done any type of research on this, but it strikes me that the reason that provision was taken out was because the legislature was concerned that if you counted votes for a particular person who was not eligible to even hold the office, that might skew the vote count for the other candidates who were eligible to hold the office, so that perhaps no one really got a majority if the votes for the ineligible candidate were counted. I suspect that was the reason for taking it out. But as far as the text of the Constitution goes, it was a totally redundant provision. It didn't add anything, and its elimination didn't subtract anything from the language that remained in the Constitution.
Let me tell you what's bothering me. What's bothering me is all this use of history is interesting, and as an American legal historian, I think it's good, but we're mixing things up. We look at history, but we look at it in today's lights. When the Constitution was adopted, and ultimately in 1853 when Supreme Court justices were elected, they were done on partisan ballots. Now we think about it as nonpartisan, and judges shouldn't be elected in partisan elections. It was partisan. It wasn't until later in the 19th century that judges got onto nonpartisan ballots and et cetera. So, and we look at this history and we look at it in terms of today's code of not participating in party elections. But at that time, that probably wasn't true. And that you had people in party conventions, and you still have judges going to party conventions. So what seems to me is that we're looking at the history with, in part, our current thoughts about nonpartisan elections, etc. And I think if you take that out, I'm not sure you get to the same interpretation of this history.
I think you do.
Okay.
I think you do.
You have the right to your opinion, Mr. Balistrieri. Tell me why.
Because of the comments that were made by Mr. Ryan at the convention regarding, in particular, regarding the difference between a legislative type official and a judicial official. And those comments are every bit as valid whether the judge happened to be elected on a partisan ballot or a nonpartisan ballot. Judges were still supposed to be neutral, whether it was a Republican judge, whether it was a Democrat judge, the judge was still expected to be neutral. The critical distinction is not the distinction between Republican and Democrat or whatever parties were in existence in 1848. I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. Republicans weren't in existence.
No nothings.
I think that was one of the parties. The Democrats were in existence.
Whigs, no nothings.
The Democrats I know go back to like the 1820s. The Republicans, I
don't think I'd choose to run on a no nothing ticket. Go ahead.
Hey, we're against the Irish.
Correctly so. But at any rate, the real concern was not partisan versus nonpartisan. It was judicial position versus legislative position, and those concerns apply across the board.
But Mr. Balistrieri, that didn't apply to a county judge. As far as I can understand, and I think the legislature recognized this at one point, someone could be a county judge and a member of the legislature. It's only circuit judges who were barred.
I don't recall if that was...
Well, but that's what the statute...
crystal clear.
I'm sorry?
That's crystal clear. You go, I mean, it says circuit judges, circuit courts in the original text. In fact, I think there was a statute that someone has cited here that county judges are accepted from that prohibition.
As I recall, I could be wrong, but as I recall, the original text of the Constitution just said judges.
No, each of the judges of the Supreme and Circuit Courts. Somewhere down the line, there were county courts and specialized judges, and county courts weren't abolished until 1978.
Well, my answer to that, then, my answer is simply what I've said previously, and that is that this is not a perfect solution to all the problems, and it was never intended to be a perfect solution to all the problems, but it was intended to simply address the most egregious problem.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Mr. Whitcomb, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. There are 264 judges of record which are affected by this provision of the Wisconsin Constitution. 264 fine people that, by their own choosing, may seek a different position other than judicial, or by the choice of the electorate may be called to another position, or by the choice of the chief executive, who may wish to appoint 264 of these affected judges to a non-judicial position of public trust. I respectfully submit that by resigning, that person is eligible to hold such a position, non-judicial position of public trust, whether by appointment, election, or otherwise, within the meaning and the intent of the Constitution. There is absolutely no rational basis that has been articulated or presented or that I found to disqualify a resigned judge from holding another political office. None. How does a judge, a sitting judge, judge of record, use his position to further future political ends? Today, a judge cannot be a candidate unless he resigns, so he's off the bench. Number two, cases are assigned to judges by random selection. Three, any party is entitled to file a substitution against a judge. And four, under our rotation system today, at least in the civil bench, it's almost become a rarity that the judge assigned to the case initially will be the judge eventually that decides the case if it goes the distance.
Now, I don't want to... Basically, your position is the most commonsensical, except I just want to call your attention. When you sit on a single-judge county, you know, you just walk around the bench. There isn't, other than substitution, you're handling all of the cases for years and years and years in that jurisdiction as a circuit judge. So, you don't, there isn't rotation in more than half the counties in this state. There is not rotation. Because you have, or let's say you have, that's not true, because I'm talking mainly of the single judge counties, of which there are, I believe, 35 or 36.
Except that. I'd just like to conclude with words that I believe are as true today as they were spoken in 1847. Another objection to the elective mode is that the judges may be induced to render unjust decisions in order to secure a re-election. This supposes the pre-existence of a weak and corrupt judge, that the parties interested are of opposite politics, or that one has very considerable and the other very little political influence, and that a decision is to be made not long before an election. An argument which requires the concurrence of so many improbabilities is not entitled to much weight. Nothing in this country would sooner seal the political doom of any judge
by all parties and every honest man than the attempt to bend his decisions from the line of justice to make political capital. Neither would the mingling of judges in the strife of politics be tolerated by the people. Their sense of propriety would revolt at the idea, and instead of securing the object aimed at, they would ensure their own defeat. He alone can be a popular judge who is honest, impartial, decided, and fearless, who holds with a steady hand the scales of justice, and will suffer no improper influences to approach them, whose judgment, though it may sometimes waver and tremble in doubt, ultimately points steadily to the pole of eternal truth and justice. Such a man the people appreciate, and him they will delight to honor. I respectfully submit that with those thoughts and with those concerns, Article 7, Section 10 of the Wisconsin Constitution was adopted, and the concern was not with corruption, the concern was solely with dual office holding, and that a resigned judge poses no threat to either the Constitution or to the honesty of politics in the state to permit such a judge to seek a position of public trust other than judicial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitcomb. Thank you, Mr. Kearney, and thank you, Mr. Bilasperi, for your arguments and your interesting briefs, including the appendices with all the historical material. That concludes our hearing in 02-03750A.